man, it's like differentiating between the brain and the information the brain is holding. Which part is the intelligence? It's not the structure, really, is it? The structure is this clever construct, but you could still be a dope even though you have a brain.
I know people like that.
Hello and welcome to Terrifying Robot Dog, episode 9 for Friday, June 5th, 2015. I'm Jonathan Stark.
And I'm Kelly Shaver.
And we're here to talk about how technology is changing the way we interact with the world. This week, we talk about artificial intelligence, what it is, when it's coming, and what it can do for us. Please stay tuned. Terrifying Robot Dog is next.
I, for one, welcome our new robot overlords.
Robot dog overlords.
Yeah, DARPA challenge is going on right now.
That is really interesting timing. We should link to that.
We should. I'm rooting for the robot dog.
Is the robot dog in the challenge?
I believe it is.
So for folks who don't know, the title of this podcast comes from the title of an episode of our older podcast, The Niche Podcast, where we talked about a robot from Boston Scientific that looks a lot like a big dog. It was called Big Dog, with no head. It was like an exoskeleton of a dog with no head, and it was pretty terrifying. Anyway, so before we get started, we just wanted to take a second to thank our 2 5-star reviewers on iTunes.
Woo-hoo! You are 5-star reviewers.
That is right. Coleman McFarlane and Jen Washington, thank you very much for rating us on iTunes.
Your checks are in the mail.
The rest of you, hightail it over to iTunes and give us some more 5-star reviews if you like the show, because 2 people is not enough to have an actual rating. You have to have a bunch of people. So if you wouldn't mind,
I'd even be happy with a 4-star review.
Yes. Any of those stars, 4 or 5.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, you know, if there's something you're not happy about, let us know.
On Twitter.
Yes.
Not on iTunes, because it's permanent.
Right.
And we will accommodate you. All right. Well, thanks very much, folks, for you 2 guys or gals. I don't know if G-E-N is a girl or a guy.
I'm Washington. Assuming.
Maybe it's General George Washington.
Maybe.
That would be impressive. So
a head in a jar somewhere. Futurama-esque.
Nice segue into our episode this week on artificial intelligence.
You caught that.
Speaking of heads in jars. So, Kelly and I recently watched a wonderful, suspenseful, terrifying movie called Ex Machina.
Yes.
About which we can say almost nothing without potentially ruining the movie for you. But if you're into thrillers and with a sci-fi angle, you will love it.
Yes, and a music score that very, very much complements the storyline.
Yeah, you know what? I didn't consciously register that, but now that you say it, you're right. That's really cool. It's great. We shouldn't talk about it because we're going to ruin it, but it's a great movie. There's no explosions in spaceships or anything. It's not that kind of sci-fi.
It's not a full of jump scenes horror movie.
No, not at all. It's the most edge of your seat suspenseful thriller I've watched in a long time. So
yeah.
fun movie. But there are other movies, not similar per se, but that tie into a similar concept that we're going to talk about today. Blade Runner is another one, big time, very mm-hmm. lot of similarities there. And also, I recently watched an arc of episodes with Cooper in the Star Wars Clone Wars cartoon where it's not artificial intelligence and it's not robots and it's not androids, but it's clones that have, they're sort of, it's not AI exactly, but I feel like it touches on a lot of the same topics that we'll get into, but we'll get into them when we get into them, but there's all these sorts of sci-fi popular culture references that sort of seem like they might not be so sci-fi forever. So let's start off by talking about what the heck is an AI anyway, because I've caught myself in the last week thinking about this episode and mm-hmm. and kind of conflating a bunch of different things that are maybe related or often adjacent. So AI, a lot of times AI gets mixed up with robots, and they're not necessarily the same thing at all.
No.
A robot might have AI, and that would make a really cool robot.
But it doesn't necessarily.
Yeah, AI might not have a, I mean, do you want, like, what's a, I mean, a robot body, I guess, is kind of like computer output, right? Like, if a robot body can do something, that's kind of like a printer in a way. It's like
an output
mechanism.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, an AI could just be, like, a Neuromancer AI is just floating around on the internet, like, wreaking havoc. Another one is, another book that talks about it is Daemon by Daniel Suarez. It's like an AI in the internet. But so many things are connected to the internet that it actually is capable of paying humans to do things. It's wild.
Right. There's a similar AI in the later books of the Ender Quartet, the later four books there.
I only read the first one.
Oh, the second and third one are great.
Oh, that's good to know. So the concept of an AI is separate from the concept of a robot. And I think I think throughout this episode, we'll be able to just focus on the AI part itself and not so much the robot part, although it's going to be maybe a little tricky. So while we were researching the episode, you linked me to Isaac Asimov's...
Three Laws of Robotics, yeah.
Three Laws of Lobotics. Yeah, we've got word dyslexia today.
We do.
Or is it DERD Wislexia?
Something.
And... So what's interesting, speaking of conflating AI with robots, is that the three laws are not about robots. They're about robots with AI.
Right.
So what's the word? Self or like autonomous robots. Yeah. Okay. So why don't we start with the Asimov's three laws of robotics or robots?
A robot may not injure a human being or through inaction allow a human being to come to harm is our first one.
Mm-hmm. Law number two.
Law number two, a robot must obey orders given it by human beings, except when such orders would conflict with the first law.
Hmm.
And number three, a robot must protect its own existence so long as such protection does not conflict with the first or second law.
Hmm. So what that implies is that the robot can think.
What it implies is that it can think and it's expensive.
And it's expensive?
Yeah, it has to protect itself.
Oh, I didn't even think about it like that. Yeah, like it wouldn't... That's funny. I didn't think of that. Like the person who's programming it doesn't want their robot to get like blown up or destroyed or
right,
whatever.
Yeah.
So they're, it's really more of a, it's not a self-preservation. I took it as self-preservation, but it's not. I think all those laws are actually AI laws because you wouldn't need.
I think
need,
they are, yeah.
Yeah, you wouldn't need a robot to, the AI wouldn't need a robot output. I got to think of this robot as an output mechanism because it could, like in the Suarez book, it could just hire... You could just like transfer money to bank accounts for people to go assassinate other people.
Right. You could just hire hitmen.
Right. So really, those are three laws that I think are applicable in general to AI.
Mm-hmm.
Although when Asimov was writing, there was no such thing as the internet. So the idea of a connected cyber world wouldn't have made any sense.
Yeah, the separation of a robot from artificial intelligence was not a concept then.
Mm-hmm. So the three laws of robotics, they sort of imply or suggest a lot of fear of robots like attacking people or the Skynet Terminator concept where they immediately decide like, oh, you know what's wrong with this planet? There's this virus called humans and we should get rid of it. So, if we fast forward to modern times, I think we're doing some research on Elon Musk, who comes up on the show quite a bit, of course.
Yes.
And his inherent fear of AI and how I think Stephen Hawking and like Bill Gates kind of joined him.
On board with this too.
Yeah. So what's that whole story?
Yeah. They're not saying AI is a thing we should never do. They're just saying this is something we need to be careful about. And Elon Musk has actually invested like $10 million into research into making AI safe. And so I guess the whole idea is just that if we're going to start giving computers the capacity to think and learn and reason in a way that's similar to what humans do, then we do need to be cautious and we do need to have safeguards built in and be careful about how we approach that so that they don't, you know, cause harm, I guess.
Yeah.
I
mean, anybody that programs computers knows that you introduce bugs, A, and B, anything that's even mildly complex, never mind wildly complex, has all kind, like every change you make has unintended consequences.
Yes.
And if the thing that you're programming is, oh, I don't know, a military AI or like RoboCop. I mean, the whole RoboCop movie was like was based on this premise of a bug, right? A bug with a machine gun. So anyway, all right. So it gets freaky. So the headlines, I saw these headlines and they're just very much like, Elon Musk is cowering under a desk because of AI. Find out why.
I know the actual articles I read went into a lot more of, he urges caution and he's giving a bunch of money to this foundation and this is what the foundation does and apply for your grant here and that sort of thing. But it went into very little detail about why they're actually afraid of this.
Hmm.
But I can only assume that it's the potential for a learning creature. There we go. I'm calling artificial intelligence a creature now.
Yeah, I actually wanted to talk about that at a certain point because there's the – and that ties in with the clone thing and the so you have this – imagine, if you will, that you do create an AI and it is in an android that's shaped like a human. And or like even the terrifying robot dog in the robot dog video, as like this thing is so scary looking and sounding and everything about it is just so scary. And then
the guy comes up and kicks it.
And I felt bad for it.
Yeah, I did too. And that alone is kind of creepy.
Yes.
But you got to think about as soon as we manage to create an artificial intelligence, we're suddenly sharing the earth with another intelligent species that didn't exist before. It's like an alien invasion
that we built.
Yeah.
What is it though? Is it not just a computer? We have computers.
Oh, see, that's where we get back to defining artificial intelligence. Is the artificial intelligence we're talking about here a computer that's capable of learning and thinking and reasoning and becoming more intelligent on its own and making decisions and inferences and having morals and ethics? Or are we talking about a computer with algorithms so good that it kind of fakes all of that to a point that we can't recognize the difference?
Right.
And
so you get so it's kind of like on one side of the fence, you have a computer program that was authored in such a clever way that it can pass the Turing test, no problem.
But it does nothing more.
Right.
And then than what we tell it to do.
And then on the other side of the fence, you have something that is, you know, in both cases, you have something that can program itself. But will that turn into something that's just excellent at passing the Turing test? Or is it something that can teach itself to acquire feelings and experience emotional pain? At which point, I think you do have to feel bad for kicking it.
Yeah.
Because even though it doesn't hurt, it's a rude thing to do.
Yeah.
So you're,
and I think you have to be a little bit afraid of kicking it.
Yes, probably because of the machine gun, but also because it's like what are you teaching it? You know? So right. it gets super weird. Like, should I? And then I think there's almost certainly what will end up happening is that it won't matter because people are going to behave as though they have feelings if they look real enough.
I think so, yeah.
So let's talk for a second about what the Turing test is. I could describe it or you could describe it.
Go for it.
All right. So I'm going to probably butcher the concept, but just to oversimplify, Alan Turing was just a genius level code breaker in World War II, broke the Germans' Enigma code so that we could... So that the Allies could, figure out where U-boats were going to be, et cetera. And back then, we're talking about like a gigantic warehouse full of what almost looked like weaving machines. You know, just like these huge mechanical, like there was no microcomputer. It was just these huge, giant machines.
Vacuum tubes everywhere.
Yeah. And he, in that context, came up with the concept of, he sort of envisioned a future computer. He basically pictured what was coming. And he was like, at some point, there will be a computer that will be able to fool you into thinking that it's a human. And the thought experiment basically goes like this. A person goes up to a slot in the wall and inserts a question on a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. And something inside the room slips back out the answer on a piece of paper. And if the person on the outside of the room can... no matter how many questions they slide through the slot, can't tell whether or not the thing inside the room is a person or a computer, then...
It's passed the Turing test.
And so like an example of An example of a really hard question for a computer to answer would be like, what should we do to break the ice? Slide that through the slot as your first question. No computer on the planet could answer that probably right now. Maybe, I wouldn't think. I mean, that's a brutally hard question to answer for a computer because it makes no sense whatsoever.
Right.
If you look at the individual words.
On the other hand, I don't know if, did you ever watch Watson, the episode of Watson playing Jeopardy?
Yes, it's impressive.
It is. But it's just, it's really fast search. I wonder if something with significantly fast search and a significantly fast database could be taught. So this is where we get into natural language processing.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to understand alternate meanings from words based on their context.
Well, here's the thing that came up in that video by Jeff Hawkins, which we'll link to in the quote, is that he posits that passing the Turing test is a red herring. He's like, who cares if you can tell if it's a human or a computer? It doesn't mean it can't learn. So I tend to subscribe to that model where it's like the Turing test is an interesting thing. It's an interesting challenge, but that doesn't mean that it's an AI if you can pass it.
Yeah, it's not the be all and end all of whether or not this is a machine capable of learning.
Yeah, it's a machine capable of fooling other people into thinking that it's human. It's like the last week, Google I.O., I don't know if you saw the keynote, but they released this new thing called Google Photos that depends heavily on their deep neural networks that they have set up for their knowledge graph.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like an object-oriented programming concept, but that is touching on so much data that it almost goes to a new level. It's like object-oriented programming, but based on user input. So it's like you've got code that somebody actually explicitly wrote or teams of people explicitly wrote, but it's so heavily based on input from Google search and all the other Google behaviors that they're tracking that the code isn't really probably the most important part. It's just how it reacts to all of the big data crunching that it's doing.
Yeah, and you could say that it is learning because it's taking all of that data and it's crunching it and it's getting useful information out of it. And I mean, you go to Google Images and you search for a picture of a car, and then you click on an image, Google's going to know, okay, that image is probably a car, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can even paste in an image,
yeah,
and it'll find other similar images and it will tell you like what's in the picture, who's in the picture.
Mm-hmm.
But Photos application actually does something that's really, really impressive, bordering on scary.
Oh, what's that?
Which is that, you know, it's kind of like Dropbox. They want you to hook your phone up to it so that all of your pictures just get uploaded.
Mm-hmm.
And once you do that, if you say, you know what, I'm sick of Dropbox or it's filling up my hard drive, I want to put all this stuff in Google Photos. And you can upload all these pictures.
Okay.
And when you do it, it breaks down, it analyzes the photos and it breaks them into people, places, and things, that sort of stuff. So you could then go back and search for something like, you know, you uploaded your picture, not tagged, nothing. You can go back and search for lightning or snowstorm or snowstorm in Toronto. Kiss my ascotee or whatever it's called.
Canonascus.
Canonascus, exactly. You could search for Canonascus. You could search for cats, and you didn't tag anything, but it can recognize cats, it can recognize tree frogs, all that stuff. So here's what's super duper crazy. They did a demo, and I've actually heard a person in real life tell me the same thing happened, where the guy uploads his photos, he searches for his son, you know, his son's like 25, so of course it finds the graduation pictures and all that stuff, but it found and identified him going all the way back to when he was born.
That is creepy.
Yeah, that is wild.
That's creepy and awesome at the same time.
Yeah. So even though obviously your appearance changes a little bit from the time you're a baby to when you're a 25-year-old.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, it was able to identify based on who knows some variety of factors that
wild.
Yeah, it's just intense. So I mean, maybe it's saying like, oh, you know, I know these pictures are all from the same family. I know that someone in this family was born in this date. Here's a baby. It's probably this same guy who's 25 now in this picture that I know was taken 25 years later.
Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? But it did something.
And can you call that intelligence?
Right, that's the thing. Like, the code didn't get any smarter, but what got interesting was so much data was added to it that the code became more useful.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not really, man, it's like differentiating between the brain and the information the brain is holding. Which part is the intelligence? It's not the structure, really, is it? The structure is this clever construct, but you could still be a dope even though you have a brain.
I know people like that.
I've heard of them. So, you know, which is the piece? Is it the acquisition of knowledge that means learning, or is it the understanding of the acquired knowledge? This is obviously something that people debate all the time.
We could go all philosophical on it for hours.
Right. So what are the benefits of it? Like, why do we even care? Why do we even care about artificial intelligence?
I think in part we care because there's this assumption that it will make the interaction between computers and humans easier, because you could just kind of naturally converse with a computer in the way that you would another human being.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that's ever going to be the case, and I'm actually not sure it's the most efficient way to use a computer. Mm-hmm. Even if it is initially the most comfortable, I'm not sure it's the most efficient.
Right.
But really, why do we care? I think the reason companies like Google and what have you, why the reason they care is because they've amassed so much massive amounts of data that eventually it's going to get to a point where we can't just run our conventional algorithms and programs and things on it and get useful bits out of it. We're going to need some kind of automated thing there that can make decisions about, okay, this is data worth looking at, this is junk, this is in order to continue doing what they're doing.
Right. It's like a meta. It's like, instead of writing a program, I want to write a program that writes programs.
Yeah. And it's like what you were saying a couple of episodes ago with the home automation thing. Yeah. You want these sensors to collect all this data, but you don't want to see all the data points. You just want to know when something's off.
Right.
So you want something that's sufficiently capable of looking at those data points and saying, hey, this isn't right.
Mm-hmm.
But with artificial intelligence, we're talking about doing that on a much larger scale with like Google's database of information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, in fact, my feeling about that is heavily inspired by that, the talk I saw by Jeff Hawkins in the membrane computing thing, where he was like, passing the Turing test is a red herring. That's not what we need. He also doesn't think big data is important. He thinks it's important to pass all of the data. He doesn't think storing the data is important. He's like, right. instead of thinking of AI as something that needs to pass the Turing test and is something that's based on big data, let's look at it like, oh, I don't know, something we know that is intelligent, like the human brain, and create a construct that's similar to the human brain, because it's the only example we have of something that can learn.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, the way the human brain works is that information, you know, comes in through the senses, it passes through the brain. It is not stored by the brain. Lots of it is thrown away. And the things you remember are the things that stand out. So his whole concept is that your senses can only, he actually knew like the, I remember him talking about the amount of megabits of information that your brain gets every day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It was kind of an interesting way to think about it.
Yeah.
And he was like, if you 1,000x that, 1,000,000x that by what's going through Google or Facebook or Amazon, and you use the same concept where you're not storing all the data necessarily, or that's not the interesting part at least, you're passing it through something that decides whether or not something's interesting and then makes note of the interesting things.
Yeah, or whether it's a thing worth storing, and then suddenly you have a new memory.
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly where I think the smart home thing needs to go, which is that, you know, it doesn't, you don't need to, you don't want to look at the data. You don't even want to look at the reports, even though that's probably the first thing that will come out of it. You really just want to know what the exceptions are.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is where the AI comes in. Once exceptions have been captured and are identified, then what needs to happen is an alert would go to the homeowner. But what would be AI would be for the alert to go to an automation that could make decisions as good or better than the homeowner about what to do in the case of the exception.
Right. oh, there's rust in the water. We should call the water heater guy.
Yeah. And I just like, and open the door when he gets here, et cetera, you know, and watch him do the work. And like, you don't even, you know, it's like program the person out of the house. Is it artificial intelligence? Like, do we want that because, or do we think AI is the thing that's going to get us there because it seems too complicated to us to program for every eventuality. So we just need something. Are we just like punting?
Something human-like?
Yeah, we're just punting.
I feel like there's probably a more deeper desire to create something human-like that's purely psychological, mm-hmm. possibly biological, that has nothing to do with solving these problems, that it's just a...
Oh, a God complex in programmers? Yeah. Oh, wow. I could see
more
that.
More of a kind of a because we can thing.
Mm-hmm. Because it's inevitable, it might as well be me.
I don't know. I mean, we're touching on all kinds of of interesting philosophical things there, but I feel like that's at least part of the drive behind wanting to make quote unquote artificial intelligence as human like as possible.
Mm-hmm. Right. Huh. I mean, the promise of AI, I suppose, is that we'll be able to use computers, including robots, to do low-level menial stuff that then we don't have to do as humans, which would, like all technological advances, increases wealth. Yeah. So, you know, if you wanted to, there's a great TED Talk about ideas having sex, which is the title of it, When Ideas Have Sex, about trade among tribes of humans way back in the old school. The way old school, and that's the major separation between the not just humans, but the current iteration of humans and any other species that came before it, because
we can cooperate.
Yeah, we can cooperate. We can trade. We can do so. Like if you know, we can specialize. We don't have to cover all our bases.
Right. I don't need to know how to grow my own food because I can go to the store and buy it.
Right. And the example he gave was that, you know, in, geez, I want to say the 1700s or like before electrical power, it would take something like 2 hours of work to generate enough, to generate a candle so that you could basically do anything in your house after it got dark. So, you know, and the amount of labor it takes now to buy, you know, to make everything happen, that you can buy a light bulb and pay for electricity and all that, is something like 10 seconds
right
per candlelight hour at night. And so that is an example of, you know, all of these people, sort of all these different ideas commingling and creating new ideas and new ideas and new ideas that generates real wealth, which, you know, extends daylight for like a trivial investment. And if we had the AI, I suppose, would be that next level where you get to more of a Wall-E cruise spaceship type situation. But hopefully we wouldn't just drink big, huge Slurpees and watch movies.
We would
creative stuff and do, you know, comedy shows and play music and do all sorts of interesting artistic creative pursuits.
Yeah, and free up our time for even greater scientific discoveries.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then we could start collaborating with the machines.
Procreating with the machines, if you like, will.
I had this terrifying mental image of like an artificial and a sufficiently smart artificial intelligence educating small children.
Right, like that. You could almost see like from a programming challenge standpoint, you'd almost think, oh, that might be easier because they're dealing with maybe a different more limited worldview. You know, it's a smaller realm of things they can...
Yes, but a much less emotionally mature worldview.
Yeah, it's like, but that's what's scary about it is that they're just so like the robot nanny is, yikes. What, so let's pull it back to like, what do you think will happen near term or near, what's the nearest term thing you can imagine happening in this space?
The nearest term thing I can happen imagining, I think it probably is in the search space. And probably sort of in the automation space, which with like Alexa and that sort of thing where you will have, you know, I do think smart homes are probably.
Yeah. Or smart buildings, maybe.
Smart buildings.
Industrial.
Yeah. And maybe transportation.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Military, of course.
Yeah. which seems kind of it seems kind of anticlimactic because it's going back to other things we've talked about. But I do feel like those are the areas where AI is going to come in first.
Mm-hmm.
Military reminds me of there's an old Star Trek episode where there's two planets are at war. And it's gotten to the point where the war is fought by the computers, and then they just kind of line up people and send them to these chambers to...
That's so horrifying.
It's like the computer determined that this many people died today in your war.
Right.
And then they go and line them up.
Yeah, Kirk and crew come down, and they're like, what are you guys all lining up for? And they're like, oh, we're going to be dematerialized.
Like, why? Permanently. Well, because the computer said that many people died in our war today.
Yeah.
And they're just like... That's stupid. Stop.
Yeah. And they're even playing sounds in the background of like bombs going off, but they were all virtual. It was super creepy. It was that was a really weird episode.
Yeah.
So anyway,
I don't know. What do you think?
I agree. I think smart homes or precursors to smart homes, like smart restaurants and smart factories, mm-hmm. will be an early first. I wouldn't really call it AI though. I think probably the true AI type stuff is going to be purely digital inputting and output. I think it's like you said, search or big data crunching, that kind of stuff where it's like it's a block of code that isn't rewriting itself per se, but is operating on such a huge data set that what it can do is drastically increased the more you feed into it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the benefits of the network effect. So obvious, you know, Amazon, Facebook, and Google are obvious ones right now. I mean, those are all machine learning companies where, Apple's a huge company, but it's not a machine learning company. Apple's never going to come anywhere. They're not going to even swing for this fence.
No, they're just going to make the sexy aluminum glass robot body.
Exactly. Of course, Apple have the hottest robots.
Yeah.
Naturally.
They have chamfered edges, and they come in gold.
Oh, man. That's our show for this week. I'm Jonathan Stark.
And I'm Kelly Shaver.
And we hope you join us again next week for our gadget episode of Terrifying Robot Dog. See you then.
Bye.
Would you like to support Terrifying Robot Dog? Just think of two friends who would dig the show and send them to terrifyingrobotdog.com for links to iTunes, Facebook, and RSS feeds. If you don't have two friends, you could still help us out by leaving a nice review in iTunes. Thanks.